There are two alternative bases for reversing the judgment below. We feel the argument based on pre-regulation law is adequately addressed in our brief. And with the court's permission, I'd like to turn my attention to the regulation, which we believe is entitled to Chevron deference.
Before you do, let me just ask you this. If Congress thought the Supreme Court got it wrong in Colony, why didn't it legislate to change Colony in the ensuing 52 years? It changed the statute many times.
Well,
but it left this particular interpretation in place.
I don't think that the 1954 revisions to the code were made prior to the decision in Colony. I can't answer the question why they didn't act. There are numerous Supreme Court cases, in particular United States versus the State of Romani is one of them, that says Congress's failure to act lacks significance. Congress doesn't legislate by failing to act. It legislates by enacting laws. So it's our position that Congress's failure to overrule Colony is without significance. Furthermore, Congress usually acts because somebody submits a bill, and that seems not to have happened in this particular case.
I know you want to talk about the regulations. I want to just ask you to zero in on something.
I'm happy to answer any questions the court has.
I appreciate that. Temporary regulations last 3 years, but the IRS wants to reach back 3 years to apply this one, and that would double the effective length of the temporary regulation. Missing something? I was looking at page 26, that footnote 3, where it says of the red brief, the IRS mailed the notice of deficiency on April 13, 2006. The regulations were not issued until September 24, 2009. More than 3 years after the notice of deficiency was issued? Because if that's so, it just seems, you know, fundamentally unfair to reach back in time with a temporary regulation that would have expired by now if it had been in place at the relevant time. And then without the regulation, you've got, you know, Colony. And we'd be disagreeing with the Supreme Court, or am I completely off the wall here?
Well, the applicant, there is a specific provision in the regulations about their applicability. The regulations say they apply to any assessment period that has not expired on September 24th, 2009, which is the date the regs were promulgated. So then the question is, what does the applicable assessment period mean? Well, that is interpreted by a notice issued by Chief Counsel, which says the applicable assessment period means any assessment period as interpreted in the regulations. So basically, the regulations make the applicable period the six-year period. And frankly, if there were no such, suppose for argument's sake that sentence had not been added to the regulation, under 7805B, the regulations would be presumptively retroactive, because 7805B as in effect, the version of 7805B as in effect for the tax years an issue under the 1994 code says that all regulations are presumptively retroactive unless the regulation otherwise specifies.
Well, if Treasury intended for the new regulation to apply to some taxes that had expired before September 24, 09, why include the date at all? Doesn't the inclusion of the specific deadline indicate that the regulation was not intended to apply retroactively?
No. The regulation could say these regulations apply prospectively only. It doesn't. It says these regulations apply to any assessment period that is open as of September 24th. So then you ask the question, so what assessment period is open? Obviously, everyone would agree that the three-year assessment period is open. So obviously, if your return, you know, if your return was a 2006 return and your taxes were due to be paid August 15th, 2007, that is a year preceding the date of the adoption of the regulation, yet nobody would contend that the regulation doesn't apply to it. So,
yeah, see, forgive me, but I may sound like a simpleton to you because you are so, you know, well-versed and so terrific at this, but...
I know you're not. I've read your opinions, Your Honor. So I've read your opinions. I know you're not a simpleton.
Oh, thank you. Okay. But truly, what we have here is this. The IRS wrote these regulations in the middle of litigating this very issue. And, you know, saying that the temporary regulation clarifies the statute. But the question that we've got to, you know, wrestle with is whether we have to give Chevron deference to a temporary regulation that was passed without any notice, without any comment, in the midst of litigation, 50 years after the statute was enacted, and that would have an arguably retroactive effect on these particular taxpayers who are litigating this particular issue.
Well, your Honor has sort of, there are several subsidiary issues in your question. United States versus Morton is a Supreme Court case that's very similar to this case. In that case, the United States had lost the case in the Court of Federal Claims. After final, I can give you the cite.
We've got it right here in your brief. I'm just looking for
okay. The United States had lost that case in the Court of Federal Claims, and the loss was affirmed by the Federal Circuit. After the government lost a case, the United States promulgated a regulation which would have the effect of reversing the lower court judgment. The Supreme Court held that it was entitled to Chevron deference, and it upheld its applicability to that case. And the court said, the court held that the promulgation of its 517 U.S., the language I'm going to quote is at 467 U.S. 836, note 21. The court held that the promulgation of the regulation after the commencement of the action was of no consequence to its validity. The court added that Congress authorized the issuance of regulations so that problems arising in the administration of the statute could be addressed. Litigation often brings to light latent ambiguity or unanswered questions that might otherwise be apparent, and that basically the agency was doing more than the task that Congress has delegated to it.
But, you know, the taxpayers maintain that Morton is distinguishable because the regulations at issue in that case were promulgated pursuant to an explicit delegation from Congress to promulgate regulations on the very point that was at issue in the litigation.
Well,
this is certainly not the case here.
This court in Bankers Life and Casualty has explicitly given Chevron deference to interpretive regulations which are issued pursuant to the commissioner's authority under 7805A of the Internal Revenue Code to promulgate all rules and regulations necessary for the enforcement of that title. So the point that opposing counsel is arguing is really not an open question in this court. That court has already decided it in Bankers Life and Casualty. I believe Judge Evans wrote the opinion in that case. The only open question in this court on Chevron deference is whether deference can be given to temporary regulations. This court left that question open in Kikelos and reserved it for another day. So I believe today is the day. So it's our position that Kikelos was decided before the Supreme Court's decisions in Meade and Barnhart versus Walton, and those cases inform the analysis of whether temporary regulations are entitled to Chevron deference. In both of those cases, the Supreme Court made it clear that the lack of notice and comment rulemaking was not determinative on the question of Chevron deference. In Meade, in particular, the court said the want of notice and comment rulemaking does not decide the case because the court had granted Chevron deference in situations where notice and comment rulemaking was not required and was also not afforded. And it further said that Chevron deference should be given in any situation where Congress has delegated the authority of the agency to make rules and regulations with force of law, and the agency has acted pursuant to that authority. And it made a specific point of saying, and the lack of notice and comment rulemaking does not decide the case because, you know, if there is some other indication of congressional intent that the agency act with the force of law, and we submit that that other indication of congressional intent that an agency act with the force of law is shown by 7805E, which specifically gives the Treasury the authority to adopt temporary regulations and gives them a duration of 3 years.
But now, in Bankers, they went through the formal notice and comment procedures.
That is correct.
Did not do that here. Does that change anything at all?
It's our position. Under Meade and Barnhart versus Walton, it does not, because in both cases, the Supreme Court pointed out that, in fact, in Barnhart versus Walton, the Supreme Court gave Chevron deference to an agency interpretation of its regulation, and the court specifically said that this interpretation is made with means less formal than notice of comment rulemaking.
I know that you're in your rebuttal, and I'll give you an extra minute for my asking you this question, but in what sense was the IRS at a special disadvantage here in uncovering the true nature of the transactions? Because they didn't omit the transaction entirely or mislabel it in some fundamental way, you know, like the taxpayer in Finney did. Why does the IRS need an extra 3 years to discover the error?
Well, to answer that question in a general way, in a typical partnership case, what you have is a partnership is a pass-through entity. In a typical partnership, you have inflated losses that are claimed on a partnership return. So it's very easy to determine from a partnership return what is going on. In a son of boss transaction, that's not the case. The inflated basis is really claimed on an individual return, but they use a partnership in order to do it. The son of boss transactions, what what gave rise to them was an IRS rule that existed in those years that a contingent liability is not taken into account for tax purposes. So every one of these son of boss cases, you have a case, in this case it was a short sale, where there is a creation of a liability that also gives rise to sale proceeds. In this case, it was a short sale. So if they don't transfer it to a partnership, they don't get this huge tax benefit. So they transfer the sale proceeds to a short sale. That's not this case in particular. This case is a little bit different. It's a sub-S corporation. But typical case, they transfer the short sale proceeds, millions, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars, to a partnership. They step up their basis in the partnership interest by the amount of the proceeds. They don't reduce their basis by the obligation to close the short sale, which in value is approximately equal to the short sale proceeds. And they don't reduce their basis because they claim that this is a contingent liability that's not taken into account for partnership basis. Well, I mean, two courts of appeals have now rejected that in the context of short sales. But so then they've used this partnership as a conduit to create this enormous basis in their partnership interest, but this does not show up on the partnership return. And frankly, it's not even clear from the individual return. What they have in this case is they state the basis, and you see a high basis, but you don't know from looking at the return that this high basis results from this wholly artificial transaction. You see a basis of $6 or $7 million, and in this case an amount realized from the sale of stock, an enormous basis that's created by this pumped up basis that results from this wholly artificial transaction. In this sense, it's very different from Colony, where the deduction in question was actually reported on the return. In Colony, you know, it was like a deduction of developmental expenses that the Supreme Court said that the IRS, you know, determined was not an allowable deduction, but was apparent from the face of the return. In none of these returns, in all these cases, is it apparent from the face of returns. And furthermore, they're using up, so you have all these returns, it's not, you know, apparent from the partnership return. You know, in fact, there's nothing, in most cases, there's nothing on the partnership return that has anything to do with this stuff, but they use the partnership to create this wholly artificial basis.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Will you please add 2 minutes to Mr. McKenzie's time?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Robert McKenzie of Arnstein & Lair. I represent Kenneth Beard and Susan Beard, the appellees. At the counsel table with me is Adam Fain of my firm. I think this is extraordinary that we have before you an attempt by a federal agency to essentially negate a Supreme Court decision. No matter where we take Chevron deference, the idea that the Supreme Court is not the final word on what the language and intent of Congress was in its statute is extraordinary. We certainly have seen the application of Chevron and Brandeis in the case of circuit court cases, but we're stepping well beyond this. Confronted with a series of losses, the Internal Revenue Commissioner then sought to issue a reg that would have retroactive effect on my client and many others. In fact, there was a cascade of decisions. The circuit court decisions came down, and the tax court, having read the two major circuit court decisions in this case, issued a whole series of cases beginning in August of 2009, continuing on. Our client was one of the first, and within a month or so after our decision was entered, having lost badly in the tax court, the commissioner felt it necessary to issue this reg, which would totally reinterpret a statute that had been interpreted 50-some years ago by the Supreme Court. So I have some problem where we're even here. Now, the ruling of the Supreme Court is very clear.
Can we go back for a minute? Since these new regulations are interpretive, as you said, they're not subject to notice and comment requirements, are they?
Interpretive regs are not subject to notice and comment. You're correct. But there's no need for interpretive regulations here if, in fact, there's a clear meaning here of the statute. There's a misreading of the Chevron and Brandeis standard, in my view, by the commissioner. If the only permissible reading of the statute is already determined by a court, we don't move to step two of Chevron where Brandeis applies. And in this case, I can't think of anything more persuasive as to the only permissible reading. You, as circuit court judges, certainly know this better than I, that when the Supreme Court speaks as to the meaning of a statute, that has great impact. So now the government would have you believe that there's another permissible reading of the statute than that given by the Supreme Court, and that then they can step into that void.
I'd like to follow up on Judge Williams' question, because you didn't distinguish the National Organization of Veterans Advocates versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs in your brief. And, you know, there the Federal Circuit held that, well, exactly what Judge Williams was talking about, that a regulation can be interpretive and therefore exempt from.
I don't concede that this is an interpreted statute to this extent. It's attempting to legislate a statute of limitations. And in
I asked that question.
I'm sorry,
in your initial statement, you said it was interpreted. I misspoke,
Judge Williams, and I was absolutely incorrect. I don't concede it was interpretive, but if it was interpretive, I don't believe that it meets the Chevron standard, because there can be no doubt that the congressional intent has been divined by the Supreme Court of the United States. So on two levels. One, I do not concede it was interpretive, because I can't think of anything more legislative than a statute of limitations. A statute of limitations is passed to put an end to litigation, to put an end to matter. And if you look at the danger that this broad view of the statute by the IRS has, they're taking the position right now that this is a bad transaction, therefore the beard should be treated badly. I can come back to that and explain why I don't believe that there was any misrepresentation here, as implied by Ms. Oppenheimer. But if we look at just the simple situation, if I have an asset, a building, and over a period of years I improve it, and I keep records so that I have a basis in that building, and I finally sell it, and I anticipate, as we would here, that I have 3 years that basis I put on the return could be audited by the IRS, and I retain the records for 3 years, and perchance, now with this reg, the IRS arrives 5 years later and demands that I prove what my basis was in this building. I no longer have the records. I no longer have the ability to prove basis. It would be standard situation when I represent people in an IRS audit. If you don't have the proof of your basis, we're going to disallow the basis that you've taken to reduce your gain.
So why don't you have the records when you've, you know, when it's...
Do people keep records forever? If you believe...
Buy a building? I think so.
Well, if you've sold that building and 3 years have gone past after the sale and you believe the statute to be 3 years, would you be at least in good position to say, I no longer need those records, I have moved on, I no longer need hordes of records on a property I no longer have?
Don't you have to keep records 7 years?
That's a standard piece of advice we tax lawyers give, but there's no statutory requirement that I know of that you keep them for some indefinite period of time. But if we put this in context of the broad reading the IRS has here now, is they've taken a position that anybody who's taking a gain on property, they're basis is subject to a six-year audit statute.
Well, looking at it from another angle, why should a taxpayer who is misrepresented or misreported his gross income be treated any differently from one who has omitted certain income? Isn't the end result underpayment of taxes the same?
Well, Congress, as Judge Rover previously pointed out to Ms. Oppenheimer, Congress could have corrected this if it felt this was a problem over 52 years. And frankly, the IRS could have come back and tried to correct this by reg well many years ago. It did not choose to do that until a flood of litigation held against its position. And when issuing regs, there's a lot of other problems in the way these regs were issued. Regs are supposed to be done in a disinterested manner where the government is, through regs, are interpreting rules. Here, they're taking a litigation position. There's no question. They lost a group of cases. A month later, they issue regs that purport to overrule those cases. That troubles me. And I don't believe they're entitled to Chevron deference. And I cannot...
Well, if they'd done it a year later, would that have been okay? Or 2 years later? I mean, if they're losing cases, they want to rethink their position, I suppose.
But should it apply to the Beards in this case? And you, Judge Rovner, of course, pointed out during Ms. Oppenheimer's presentation.
I know, but I'm the devil.
I understand that. But we have to take this, in my view, out of just the context of the Beards. And all taxpayers, should the IRS be able to open the statutes for all taxpayers, particularly those who've already won in court? We've had a judicial determination the statute of limitations expired in Beard. And then a month later, that decision is in some way overwhelmed by a regulation. If they'd have said in the reg that it was retroactive, maybe they'd have a little more standing. They said effective date, and they used some very circular language. I think the tax court got it best when they talked about that circular language in the Intermountain case. They said, irreparably marred by circular, result-driven logic in the wishful notion that the temporary regs should apply to this case because Intermountain was involved in what he believes to be an abusive tax shelter. Now, if I heard Ms. Oppenheimer's argument, she was essentially arguing my client was involved in a tax shelter, therefore he should be subject to the circular reasoning. And
what's the other side of the retroactivity question? Is whether something is retroactive if it is simply clarifying what was already there. So if this is a clarifying regulation, then how is it being applied retroactively?
Well, Your Honor, let's look at the time frame here. You point out some of the problems in time frame, but the statute would have expired in the Beards case as of April 15, 2003. We are now 6 years after that there's an attempt to extend that statute. And again, we go back to the entire reason for a statute of limitation. There must be a time when people are not at risk. There would be a way the government could have kept this statute open and we would be arguing an entirely different issue. The statute of limitations for a fraud is there is no statute for a civil audit. There's a 6-year criminal statute. There is no statute for a fraud on a tax return. If the government had felt that my client's conduct was so reprehensible, they could have argued that there was a fraud involved on that tax return and that they could audit it at any time. They did not. They made a conscious decision to take a strained view in light of Colony of 6501 and went ahead and issued a deficiency notice a full 3 years after, or almost 3 years after the statute would have expired, just days. It would have expired even in their computation as of April 15, 2006. They issued the notice of deficiency just before that strained view of 6 years. So there's some real problems with due process here. Let's take a litigating position, go forward and argue that it was a 6-year statute. Oh, my God, we've lost that litigating position. We've lost it badly. We've lost it in the circuit courts. We've lost it in the tax court. We did convince a couple district court judges of our position, but frankly, we've lost it across the board. Now let's try it by doing it by legislative, by regulation fiat.
You know, the IRS says at page 21 of their of its reply brief that you didn't respond to the argument that the regulations at issue here are presumptively retroactive unless otherwise specified. And they have a whole bunch of, you know, citations.
Well, but we did respond in our brief, Your Honor, by citing that generally the courts do not like retroactive impact of statutes or regulations. And we cited an entire series of cases where the courts were adverse to a retroactive impact. So we did not believe that we needed to respond specifically to that case. But in fact, the courts are adverse to legislative retroactive statutes, and we also cited cases where the courts were adverse to retroactive regs. We believe we have, in fact, answered that question. And there's another problem here. The statement of the basis of the reg does not reflect the litigating position now taken by the government. In the initial reg, in their statement, they stated it was to overrule Salmon Ranch and Bakersfield. But when I read the briefs the government has now presented to you, it is also taking the position that Colony was wrong. So,
Turn in Colony was much easier to look at than this complicated transaction in this case.
I understand.
And the whole purpose of what was done here, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but the whole purpose is to inflate the basis and decrease the tax responsibility.
We haven't gone to the merits of this particular case.
That's what it looks like. You agree?
Yes. I can tell you, and I will concede to the courts, and to each of you in the court, that Son of Boston transactions have not fared well in the court. Ms. Oppenheimer is right that when they are properly and timely challenged, the majority of cases have gone against the taxpayers. It is a use of a stepped-up basis. I concede that. But taxpayers in this transaction, in particular the Beards and others, had the advice of attorneys applying very complex tax laws. The attorneys doing this believed that they were applying the law correctly, I believe, although that is not necessarily conceded by the government, but they did pay a lot of money. This was a life's transaction for the Beards. They were selling their companies. It was a major transaction to sell the companies. They went to lawyers and said, how can I get the best tax treatment of this? Every businessman in the world will do that. And then they received advice they believed to be correct. They placed it on a return. The entire gross sales amount went on the return. The basis is now at issue.
But the basis isn't on a return.
The basis is on the return. The IRS disagrees with that basis, the way it was computed.
How the basis was reached. I mean, looking at this return, it's so different than what was at issue in Colony. Now, I don't know, that was 50-some years ago, but this is a much more sophisticated return than that return in Colony. You agree with that?
I agree it's a sophisticated return, but the same essentials of the transaction.
And I understand you agree, maybe just for purpose of argument, you agree that had the IRS acted here within 3 years, that you probably would have been a loser on a claim to disallow this.
Your Honor, I've represented over 60 people on Son of Boss transactions. The majority have, in fact, settled with the IRS as opposed to litigating it. So you're absolutely correct. Right. But the government was not timely here.
Okay.
So, in my view, we should not look at Chevron deference in particular, which has been argued by the government, because Chevron deference would not be appropriate where the Supreme Court has spoken, and there can be no question as to what the law is on this particular issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You used up all your time, Ms. Oppenheimer, but we helped you use up all your time. So
We will give you an extra 2 minutes, but that really is all I can give you. Okay. Or I'll be set upon by my brother and sister.
The argument that Colony is controlling here is incorrect. The Supreme Court in Brand X made it crystal clear that a judicial interpretation of statutory language cannot foreclose an agency from issuing a regulation unless the statutory language is unambiguous. The Supreme Court in Colony held that the critical language omits from gross income was ambiguous, and the same ambiguity that allowed Colony to interpret that language allowed the Treasury Department to issue a regulation clarifying the statutory language.
Do you see anything at all unequitable or unjust? I mean, I realize that the equities really won't decide this case, but do you see anything inequitable about what took place here? The timing of the...
No, Your Honor. The statute is the regulation is interpreting the 6-year statute, which involves substantial omissions of gross income, which means an understatement of more than 25% of the income that you owed. But if taxpayer had not done that, we would not be before this court. As far as reliance interests, I presume when the taxpayers got into this transaction, they may have relied on representations that the transactions itself would pass muster. Hopefully they were not also playing audit, lottery, or a game of beat the clock in hopes that, you know, in fact, they had no reasonable basis for concluding that the 3-year statute would apply. The Fifth Circuit in Finney versus Chambers held it would not, and the cases that they rely on, Salmon Ranch and Bakersfield Energy, were not decided when they got into these transactions. So I don't think anybody has a reliance interest on a statute of limitations. You have a reliance interest in the hopes that your transaction will pass muster, but I don't see anything unfair about it. And as this court held in First National Bank of Chicago versus Standard Bank of Trust, the courts have held that the general prohibition on retroactive agency rulemaking does not apply to rules that merely clarify existing law. And the Seventh Circuit law is pretty clear that an interpretation of a statutory phrase is a clarifying regulation.
Thank you. Thanks to both parties. And, of course, the case will be taken under advisement.